Chuck and Julie, bringing you the truth, straight up.
I'm Julie Hayden. I'm working
at... An Emmy-winning former investigative reporter, a highly successful trial attorney, and publisher of a major Denver area newspaper. They've been partners as talk show hosts and in marriage as parents for over 10 years, providing thought-provoking information, opinion, and entertainment live, local, and interactive. Everyone's voice is always welcome on the Chuck and Julie Show.
Oh, good afternoon. It is Monday, July 25th. And today I'm going to be speaking with John St. Augustine. We're going to talk about the Uvalde shooting again. Of course, about an hour ago, he called and told me that he had to do a meeting right at 3 o'clock, that something that he hadn't really arranged. He told somebody, hey, you know, I want you to come talk to me and meet with me. And then they said, yeah, we're going to do it Monday at 3. So he's kind of scrambling. So I'm going to have to kind of go on for about 30 minutes on stuff. So we'll see how that goes. But I want to really thank Chuck and Julie. I'm Mark Poff. I'm a friend of theirs that I guest host sometimes on their show. And I really appreciate doing it for them because I really love their show and their conservativeness and everything. And I just... You know, if I can help them out so they can get a little bit of vacation time, you know, that's great, you know, to help them out and stuff. So I'm hoping that I can help out today. And I'm going to talk about a little bit of the background of myself and John St. Augustine leading into this ahead of time. But first, you know, I always say that Biden does something stupid that gives me all kinds of things to talk about politics. And I'm not really even supposed to be talking about politics. I'm a retired cop. I used to be a computer engineer for many years. I worked for an old company called Digital Equipment Corporation. Some of you may actually know that company. Worked for them for many years in the 80s and early 90s. Then I went to go work for a government contractor that was doing top secret stuff for radar systems and all that cool stuff. So I was a computer nerd. I was an engineer, a coder, whatever you want to call me. And I'd always wanted to get into law enforcement. It was just one of those things that I really, really interest me in doing this kind of stuff. So I had an opportunity when I worked for a company called MCI. I'm sure most of you know the company, the old phone company that went out of business. Every company I've worked for, private business, has gone out of business. Digital Equipment Corporation became Compaq, became Hewlett-Packard. I have a Hewlett-Packard retirement, and I've never worked for them. Then I worked for a company named E-Systems that did some top secret stuff. They're now Raytheon. And then I got into law enforcement after MCI, which is now Verizon Business, and became a cop. I worked in a jail for about 8-9 months. I worked at the El Paso County Jail. It was really a great, you know, it was fun, great experience for me with inmates and stuff. I always figured that if you could handle 96 inmates, you could probably handle one-on-one in a traffic stop. So it gave me a lot of great experience. Then I was transferred because of my experience being in computers. I was transferred directly from the jail to investigations. I had been a reserve cop for about 5 years with the El Paso County Sheriff's Office. They counted that time for my patrol time. And I had actually done a lot of patrol during those 5 years as a reserve cop, specialized in DUIs, which I love doing. Then I went to investigation specializing in computer crimes, where I learned how to do all kinds of the cool stuff that I've talked about in the past with cell phones. You would be amazed of all the cool stuff that you can do with cell phones. I've talked about geofencing and tower dumps. There's all kinds of new stuff that's coming out. I'll probably have to do part of another show and talk about all the other new technologies that we have. So that's kind of how I got tied into law enforcement. John St. Augustine, who will be on here in a little bit, hopefully, after he gets done with this brief meeting that he has to do, he's going to jump on. And we're going to talk about Uvalde, which is just crazy. You know, I retired. Now I work for defense attorneys for the most part. I'm having more fun now than I've ever had. And I have found that law enforcement is kind of taking some liberties in some of the statements that they're saying and stuff. So I'm having a good time kind of keeping the cops honest in a lot of these cases where they say things about cell phones and cell phone records that are not true. The thing that I find the most is cops or detectives will say that the cell phone records clearly show that they were at the location of the shooting, which I will tell you, cell phone records do not place you anywhere. All they do is tell you which tower that you used when you connected to the network, nothing more, nothing less. And they try to make it sound as if it substantiates the fact that they were at the shooting or at this location, and it does not. But I have to tell you, one of the things that I found interesting this morning when I got up and looked at the news, and I was trying to find, you know, is there any craziness that's going on? Well, I guess later on this week, the second quarter of GDP is going to come out, and it's going to be bad. Everyone knows it's going to be bad. We know it's going to be bad because we feel this every day when we go out and buy gasoline. I just moved my kid from CSU. He just graduated in June to his first job in Colorado Springs. And so I had to rent a Penske truck. I didn't get a U-Haul, got a Penske. Drove all the way up to Fort Collins, then came all the way back. And then I filled the truck up. Holy cow. That was unbelievable. It was about $130. And if you have a big SUV, I'm sure some of you have experienced this, you know, how expensive it is to fill up a car. Even when the gas prices are coming down, it doesn't matter. I personally believe that the Democrats, Biden, whatever you want to, whoever you want to call these people, they want $10 a gallon because that's the only way that you can ever justify the price of the Green New Deal or windmills or solar panels. I still, you know, when they first started putting all these windmills and these solar panels out, I said, look, if they're cost effective, if they make money, if they make energy cheaper than natural gas, then by all means, put these windmills and these stupid solar panels up and, you know, let's create energy cheaper. And it's somewhat renewable, if you want to call it that. I've yet to ever see a cost analysis on these things to see if they're cost effective. And everything I keep hearing is they're not. And I agree, windmills are ugly. I still am trying to figure out the birds that they're killing and stuff, but I've seen them on fire. I'm sure you've seen the video of these windmills on fire. And the most interesting thing that I've heard, and some of you probably know more about this than I do, windmills are only rated for 20 to 30 years, and then you have to take them down. And guess what? The blades aren't biodegradable. You have to bury them. And I've seen pictures of them burying these blades. So how renewable really is windmills? And the bottom line is, are they cost effective? You know, or is the natural gas more cost effective, which burns pretty clean? So, you know, all this craziness going on with the White House, I think they want $10 a gallon gasoline so they can justify this. I also, being the, you know, I just don't trust a lot of these people. I think Biden took the opportunity to sell the strategic reserves on purpose because he wanted to get rid of it. I mean, Trump did an excellent idea. Whether you like or dislike Trump is irrelevant to me, to be honest with you. But his administration did a lot of great things. And one of them was, is when the price of gasoline tanked during the pandemic or whatever you want to call it, he loaded up the reserves with cheap gas. Well, that's terrible for Biden and for the Democrats because that means that if something happens, you have all these strategic reserves and it's oil, it's gasoline, and that's no good. So I think Biden took the opportunity to sell all of our strategic reserves, which I heard he sold to the Chinese or to the Japanese in the Asian area. And now we're not even going to have our strategic reserves because he sold it all. And it didn't really save us any money. But he took the opportunity to just get rid of it. Now, I may be cynical in thinking that Biden's trying to do things to set the table for this whole Green New Deal. But I think it backfired on him. I mean, gasoline got to five and everybody freaked out. And even the Democrats are like, you know, this is ridiculous. And, you know, and to make the stupid statement, Buttigieg is about Buddha stupid. I mean, basically saying, go buy an electric car. You know, I jokingly went to a country club. A friend of mine invited me to a country club, and I went to have dinner with them. They're good friends of mine. and he drives a Tesla. And I don't make a big deal about Teslas. I mean, I think they're cool. I've driven an S model and it is awesome to drive. So I like Teslas. I like electric cars. They're pretty cool. But I happen to drive my old Vette to the country club. So he knew he drove it and he was talking about his Tesla. And I said, hey, just to let you know, my Vette's more cost effective than your Tesla. And of course, you know, at the table, he's just like, oh, that can't be true. I mean, I have a Tesla, you know, I don't have to pay for fuel or anything. You got that Vette that's probably going to cost a fortune. I said, no, actually it's not. It gets about 25 miles per gallon and it's an older Vette. I paid $10,000 for that Vette. I got a great deal on an old Vette, paid 10 grand for it. It gets 25 miles per gallon. So how much did you pay for the Tesla and how much does it cost for you to juice your car up? Well, that was the end of the conversation. He wouldn't really talk about it, and he very quickly changed the subject. So to say that a lot of these electric cars are cost-effective is just not true, especially if you don't have solar panels. Anybody who buys an electric car and doesn't have solar panels, you're not saving anything. Now, if you want to have an electric car and drive it, for God's sakes, do it. I mean, have fun. They are fun to drive, and that's great. But if we all went out and bought Teslas, one, we couldn't afford it. But two, if we did, we'd wipe out the grid and we're not saving the planet on anything. So there's all that craziness and going to that. Well, now they know that they're going to get a pretty bad report later this week that the GDP is going to be down again. And this is their problem, is that in the definition of recession, it says that a recession is defined by two quarters of reduced GDP. Uh-oh, that's not good, because now people can say officially, per the definition, we are in a recession. Well, the White House can't have that. So they actually changed the definition of recession. They tweaked it out on the White House website. And you can see this. If you go out and Google it, you'll see it. But I actually looked it up to see, so I'm typing, I have an Apple, a Mac, and I type the word recession. I say, what's the definition? And it says, commonly known as a period of temporary economic decline during which trade and industrial activities are reduced, generally identified by a fall in GDP in two successive quarters. Well, that's going to happen later this week. That's going to be made official. Well, you can't have that. You can't have definitions based in fact. So now they've changed it to make it an opinion. Recession's not a fact that's defined by two quarters of reduced GDP, it now has to be that so many economists say that we're in a recession. Well, then you have to ask for opinions. Do you as an economist say that we're in a recession? Well, they can say whatever they want. It doesn't matter. It's like asking me for my opinion when I'm on the stand in a case. That's my opinion. And so, they've said in the past, well, we think that inflation is only going to be short term. And we have so many economists, have said that. Who are these people? Who are these economists? And I always love it when I see Janet Yellen, who I refer to as the white wit. Oh, I guess I shouldn't say that. I'm in trouble now. She says the craziest things and she's wrong more than she's right, which makes perfect sense for Joe Biden to hire her, because he's been wrong on every foreign policy issue. So now you might as well get somebody who's wrong on every economic thing and make her your Treasury Secretary, because she's always going to be wrong. She won't use the word recession. She just uses the word slowdown. So they're trying to change the definition of this so they can say that, we're not heading towards a recession. I think it's obvious at this point, we're right in the middle of a recession. I don't really care who's making the definition, whose opinion it is. We are in the middle of a recession because things are just incredibly expensive. My kid just graduated from CSU with a computer science degree, got this awesome job making all this money and stuff. And I just thought this is incredible. And then he went to go rent an apartment. And it was about $2,000 a month to rent an apartment. And I started thinking to myself, how can you get ahead, with that kind of rent? I don't care how much money you make. So you can pay people more money. It doesn't matter. It's relative. What's the bottom line? How much do I have at the end of the month that I can save towards buying a house? Because that should be the goal of almost everybody, is to try to, get enough money so you can get into your house. So they're changing the definition. To me, it's like, You know, you're going to go to your spouse. You know, don't tell them that you want a divorce. Don't go to your spouse and say, you know, hey, I want a divorce. Just go to them and say, I'd like to have a legally sanctioned prolonged absence of togetherness is really what I'm looking for here. I don't really want a divorce. So you just change the definition. You know, that way you don't have to base things in facts. So it's kind of like mostly peaceful protests. That was always one of my personal favorites. But, you know, I have to tell you, for me personally, this stuff couldn't happen at a more timely fashion as we get to November. I mean, I'm just so interested to see how November is going to play out in the elections, because I think everything's going to hell in a handbasket. And I don't see things getting better, you know, this fall. And they can't help themselves. You know, they're talking about doing mask mandates again. That's not even on my cards, you know, that I have here to keep me on script. But, I mean, they're talking about, in San Diego, they're talking about asking for mask mandates this fall. Any area that requires masks this fall is going to be taken over by the Republicans, other than maybe some crazy California area. I mean, everybody hates masks. Now, you got some far left liberals that they just love the masks. And I think it's because they don't want us to see them. You know, they just love that, you know, don't look at me. You know, I'm going to cover myself. I see people outside now in the heat of summer in 100 degree weather wearing a mask. And I'm just like, dude, where are you coming from? Now, if they want to wear a mask, you know, God love them. That's their right. And if they do have some kind of immune deficiency or something that requires it, God bless them. You know, I hope they get better and everything. But you see masses of people wearing masks, and then you see the elitists not wearing masks. But if they try to come back to masks because COVID starts ramping up, I mean, we're still being lied to about the facts when it comes to COVID. We're absolutely still being lied to about how much, you know, issues that this is causing. And now they want to bring up this monkeypox or whatever the hell that is and start talking about that. They're out of control. But, you know, I want them to just continue, to be honest with me, be honest with you. My opinion is, you know, just keep spreading this baloney, because I don't think you're fooling even your own Democrats. And a lot of the independents, this is what they don't understand. The independents, they care about themselves. And when it comes to gas prices and other things like that, and then when you have parents, my kids have grown up. My last one just graduated from college, so we're kind of done with that whole thing. But I can tell you, my wife, when my kids were in school, she was all over education, like all good parents should be. And I was actually on the school board. I think she wanted me to get on the school board to fix some things. But, you know, there's actually more that parents can. I would tell you this. There's more that parents, a group of parents, can do to change a school district than actually an individual school board member. If you get a bunch of parents together and they start going down to the school board, I can tell you, being on the other side of that, when they all get behind those microphones and start talking about stuff, you know, school boards start listening and they start, you know, trying to fix some things when there's issues. But if the school, especially the teachers unions and other things like that, which I don't think really represent all the good teachers, if they try to bring these mask mandates back in the fall, saying, hey, flu and, you know, because really COVID and flu is about the same at this point, it's all going back up. I got news for you. COVID is going to go back up during the fall, and it may go up just like the flu every winter. That's kind of where we're at. So I think it's going to be really interesting. As someone who's really not massively into politics, I am down here in El Paso County, and I've talked about this before. I think, and I'll say it again, I've never been hesitant on saying how I feel. I think the El Paso County Republican Party is the most corrupt group of politicians in the state of Colorado. And I'm just very disappointed at how they try to control the whole Republican Party down here. Instead of, it should be an open invitation group of everybody gets together and collaborates and decides who's the best person to represent us, as opposed to probably two dozen old white Republicans. I guess I shouldn't be saying that, but a bunch of old Republicans who want to call the shots on who gets to run for what. and they actually decide, you know, who gets to run for what in the next election. And they actually convince people, no, you wait and we'll make you this, you know, in 2 years. I'd like to see a big switch in the Republican Party in El Paso County. So that's kind of my politics stuff. I'm going to start heading more towards talking about Uvalde. Hopefully John will be here in about the next 10 minutes. But one thing I have learned about John, and I'm sure you've seen this in everybody that you deal with, if I tell you I'm going to meet you at a certain time, I'll be there 5-10 minutes early. It always seems like John's just a little bit late, always trying to rush to get to the next meeting and stuff. And I think it's because he has so much going on in his life that he tries to do more than he can. So hopefully he's going to make it on in the next 10 minutes. I wanted to talk about something that's really kind of bothered me a little bit. And it's about the Capitol riot or Capitol trespass on this January 6th. And I, again, I don't get too much into the politics. I like to stick to the facts as a retired cop. The one thing that's really bothered me is kind of the comparison when you talk about January 6th and what happened. And so I actually did a little checking just because I thought this is the way it was, and I just wanted to confirm it on what they estimated the damage was done to the Capitol building on January 6th. And they estimate it, and it's been a while since then, so the estimate should actually be fairly good. They estimate the damage at $1.6 million. Now, that seems like a pretty big number. Got a frog in my throat. It's actually a very small number. If you think about it, when you see the video of the trespassers, nobody's trying to rip up these, what I would think would be multi-million dollar paintings and statues and all. I mean, I've been in the Capitol multiple times, not on January 6th. I don't need to be indicted and sit in prison for something I didn't do for many, many years. But I've seen the Capitol building. They could have caused a lot of damage. I mean, a lot of damage very quickly to the Capitol. And they didn't. They did not cause that much damage to the Capitol. So let's compare that to the George Floyd riots. Totally different. I love Vicki Tompkins, just to let you know. So I think she's been good as the Republican chair, which is why they want to get rid of her. But okay, so back on this, I want to answer those questions. I'm all about grassroots, and I'm all about normal, average, everyday people running for public office, which is what I did. I was a detective, and I ran for school board 3 times and was on the school board for 12 years. That's really what it's all about, is about everyday average people representing us. It's not about elitists or certain individuals representing us. So, all right, getting back to January 6th, sorry for that little bounce. If somebody's just listening and they're like, why did he jump to that? It's because somebody asked me a question, which I am watching. So you have the George Floyd riots, whether you think it's rightful or whatever. I mean, obviously the riots are not justified at all. So how much damage did they cause writing about George Floyd, which the Democrats all thought was, well, you know, that's going to happen, you know, kind of almost justifying the actions of individuals, which was completely not right. It basically was $2 billion worth of damage. So you're looking at 1.5 or 1.6 versus $2 billion. Huge. So what about the number of people that were killed? That's kind of interesting when you talk about January 6th. So let's talk about George Floyd real quick. There was 25 deaths that they can definitely, you know, establish happened during these riots, 25 deaths. Now, depending on who you listen to or talk to about the number of deaths, I want to talk about deaths that are directly related to the actual trespass. There was really only one that can be directly related to it. I understand some people had some heart attacks. People have heart attacks every day. If you ask them to march from the White House to the Capitol, some people are probably, I mean, it's possible that they could actually have a heart attack. So I'm not really going to count those. So how many really died in the actual January 6th? There was one. And how did she die? She was shot by a Capitol Police lieutenant named Michael Byrd. And I just got a chance to look at his interview here recently. And, you know, I have to tell, I've seen the video. I've seen the raw video footage of when she got shot. Now, they've determined this to be a legal, justifiable shooting. And I will tell you from my experience, having worked on numerous homicides, police shootings, whatever you want to call it, I've seen these, and sometimes they may call it a justifiable shooting, and I get it, which means by legal standards, the individual was justified in taking that shot. But moralistically, you know, from a moral standpoint, having been a cop for numerous years, I look at that video and I'm like, he murdered her. I mean, he basically assassinated her, and he had no justification. I saw of it leading up to, you know, all this, them banging on the doors. There was all this stuff against the door that they had shoveled there. Why was he standing there by himself? There was actually Capitol Police on the other side. I mean, so you have this maybe, I don't want to say petite, but a smaller, to me, a small woman trying to sneak through the window. This is actually a door that has the window on the top half, and the window gets smashed out or whatever, and she's trying to crawl through it. I mean, literally slow crawling through this as people are trying to help her through this. And he pops out of this side door, shoots her, and then kind of pops back into this side room or whatever, and she dies. And I would tell you, why didn't he just have his weapon holstered, pop out of this room, push her back in to the crowd, and continue yelling at these people not to do it? And so for me, you know, when I saw this interview that he gave, and I get that they say that it was justified, I just, to me, on a moral standard, just because you legally can do something doesn't mean you have to. Now, I'll give you my example, and I gave a little bit of this information last Friday when I was on the show, but I want to give you kind of some more details. I, on 9/11, on the 9/11, I was in uniform out on patrol in a two-man unit, and I just, it was later in the afternoon. So we'd just gone through all this stuff in the morning about, hey, what's going on in Washington, all this other stuff. And so they wanted like every deputy out in uniform to do the, you know, to be out in case there was more coming that we didn't know about from 9/11. So I was in uniform. I was basically driving back to the barn down to Fleet to turn the car in and to go home. It was about 6 o'clock in the evening, I think, 5, 6, 7, you know, around rush hour. And a car in front of me, when the light turned green, hit the center median. I mean, the car right in, I'm in a marked police, you know, sheriff's car, right in front of me hits a median and then bounces off of that, goes all the way to the right, and then comes back onto the road. Well, in a marked unit, I mean, you got to do something. I can't just say, ah, man, I'm tired. It's late. It's 9/11, for God's sakes. I'm not going to do anything. So I had to pull this car over. I figured the guy was drunk. So I pull him over. No big deal, but it is kind of rush hour. So I pull him over to the right, pulls over. I get out of the vehicle, go up to make contact. And he steps out of his vehicle. And of course, you're not supposed to do that anymore. In the old days, you'd step out and talk to, you don't do that. You stay in your car. So I told him to get back in his car, and he didn't. And he just stood there and started talking to me. I was like, you know, this old guy, I don't know why he's doing this. Well, then I looked in the back seat of his car, and there was an assault rifle sitting there. And he ends up jumping. He sees that I see the assault rifle in the back seat. He jumps in the front seat, reaches over the seat, grabs the assault rifle. I'm sitting there kind of, you know, everybody hesitates whenever you see something. It's like, is this really happening in front of me? I'm in uniform and this guy is reaching for an assault rifle. So I ended up jumping in the vehicle with him in the back seat and started fighting for this assault rifle, took it from him. And long story short, put him in custody and arrested him. I was completely justified at the time. Yeah, I know. All right. It was an SKS rifle. I understand the whole issue with the assault rifle definition. I'm with you on that. So I was completely justified in pulling my weapon and shooting this guy. He's reaching for a rifle. And so I don't shoot. I don't pull up my handgun. I don't shoot this guy. I get in and I take the weapon from him. So I made a decision to act that way because that's what I decided to do. I was completely justified. In fact, later on, I was called into a lieutenant's office and asked why I didn't shoot the guy. I mean, that's basically the question. You know, why didn't you shoot this guy? You know, he's trying to pick up a weapon and you didn't just shoot him. Why on earth would you fight this guy for a weapon when you were completely justified in shooting him? Well, that was my decision that I made at the time, and everything worked out okay. So like I'm saying, just because you're legally can shoot someone doesn't mean that morally you should do it, and you make the decision on what you're going to do. But I have to tell you, from the video that I saw from January 6th, I would not have shot her at all. And I would have continued, you know, to hold my ground or whatever, or retreat in that situation. It's property. You are not allowed in the state of Colorado to use deadly force to protect property, which is what he was doing at this point because everybody else was gone. I mean, there was nobody else in that hallway. But I'm sure there'll be more to that, and other people will tell me that, no, there was people or whatever, but that's fine. All right, so I've wasted enough of your time. I apologize for that. So let's talk about if I were the Uvalde Police Department, would you still be there roadside? And I will tell you this, just to give you kind of the end game, and Thomas, you can bring John in whenever you want. I personally, that's the question in seeing this video, and then we're going to talk about this video. I want to talk about something else real quick before we get to Uvalde. But I would like to think if I was in that situation, they would have been trying to hold me back. I would have gone into that school. I would have marched right past all those cops, and I would have said, okay, which room is the end? And I would have gone in and say, who's with me? Hopefully, that's what I would have done in that situation. I would not be standing on the roadside or whatever waiting. You know, so how would you like to feel in a situation where you had 400 cops on scene and they waited over an hour? That's insane. So, but all right. So just real quick here, before we talk about Uvalde, I want to talk about John Benny Ramsey here real quick. If some of you have probably seen in the news that the family is again pushing to have DNA testing. So John St. Augustine is with me. I'm assuming everybody can see him at this point. John, sorry you had to go to this little meeting. I already threw you under the bus on that one.
Thanks. Sorry about that. So, and I apologize.
So real quick,
I have a little cough, so I put something in my mouth. So my apologies if it looks
so
like
you have COVID. And you're not wearing a mask. All by yourself, you're not wearing a mask. Okay.
Beware.
So how many items do you think? Now, I don't know if everybody knows this. Hopefully you've seen in the past. John actually worked on the JonBenet Ramsey homicide. He was retained by the family to do a, would you say reinvestigation? Would that be the right phrase?
Investigation. Pro bono, by the way. Pro bono.
And I've done some work like that as well on things that I find, you know, is important to me, or I think is important. So how many items do you believe was seized by law enforcement that has never had DNA testing in the JonBenet Ramsey case?
So I can tell you over the years, at least the first, maybe the first two decades. So to probably about 2016 timeframe, my guess is there were over 1,000 items that were collected, of which there are probably upwards of, I don't know, 600 to 800 items that have never been tested. Maybe even more than that. You know, the
are we talking about pieces of clothes?
It could be clothing. I can tell you, I have a report from a deal where they submitted some items for testing, and not all the items were tested, which is odd to me because in law enforcement, right? When you have a case, a murder case, and you sit down with the prosecutor, you sit down with the investigative team, you identify those items that seem to have the biggest chance of recovering DNA, right? So as an example, right, you may have a bloody shirt, or you may have, you know, a cloth with, you know, some kind of fluid on it, right? Whether it's seminal fluid, if we're talking about a sex-related death. So those are the items that typically are the ones that you want to try and get tested first to see what kind of profile you can develop from those items. And unfortunately, in the Ramsey case, the whole focus from the very beginning has always been on the family, right? It's always been that somebody in the family was involved in this murder. And so, you know, that's very dangerous because, you know, what a lot of people don't realize is that law enforcement's role is not to determine one's innocence or guilt. Their only role is to gather facts. And so, you know, when you are not willing to take evidentiary items, you know, clothing, certain items that were recovered from the scene, and you're not willing to go get those items tested, you really, you know, there's some malfeasance involved. You are responsible to get those items tested to see what kind of profile, if any profile, can be developed from those items. And, you know, one of the reasons why this case has been unsolved for now, you know, we're going on year number 26 this December. The reason why it's still unsolved is because the government, you know, the law enforcement in the Boulder community has decided not to test these items. And to me, right, whether you believe the Ramseys did it or you didn't believe they did it, that really should not play into your decision of whether or not you test an item. The bottom line is, as an investigator, as an investigating body, you're supposed to gather facts. So sometimes those facts are not good facts. And sometimes those facts may point to somebody, right? In particular, it may point to the Ramseys, and there may be an explanation for it. But, you know, what we don't know is that there's actually foreign DNA that people don't understand that was under this little girl's fingernails, on her long johns, and in her underwear that all come from a similar source. So if it's not tied to the family, whose DNA does this match up with? So what harm is done in testing all of these evidence items? There's really no harm done. You know, when you come from it from a you know, I guess a money perspective, a financial perspective, you know, the government, they have their own labs. So it's not a lot to take these items and try to develop a profile. And that's really, at the end of the day, what we're trying to do with these evidence items is to see if there's a, you know, a profile, whether it's the Ramsey's profile or somebody else. But I'll tell you what, if it's somebody else's and it matches what was in her fingernails and on her long johns, that would be a huge clue in possibly solving the murder. You know, they focused so much on the family the last 26 years that at some point, as an investigative body, you've got to say, well, maybe they didn't do it. And maybe we need to look in other areas. But when you're so focused on just the family, you lose that sight of what the other possibilities could possibly, you know, what else could have possibly happened? Who else could have possibly have been involved? And that has not, unfortunately, happened. The narrative from the very beginning is that the Ramseys did it, and they've committed to that narrative 26 years later. And that's dangerous because we know from cases like the Golden Gate killer, you know, that deputy sheriff, DeAngelis, we know from testing of DNA today is what resulted in his arrest 20 some odd, 30 years after he committed these heinous murders in the state of California. Who would have thought that a cop was involved in murdering all of these people? Well, guess what? His DNA was at all of these scenes. And we haven't taken that same objectivity in trying to figure out who was involved in the Ramsey case. We've been so focused, when I say we, law enforcement has been so focused on just the family, not all the other possibilities of you know, could somebody else have done it? Could there have been an intruder? There's definitely evidence of an intruder.
Yeah, I know there's evidence with the suitcase, and, you know, and the Boulder police announced that they didn't think there was an intruder because there was snow all around the house and there was no footprints. We know that's not true. Correct. There was not snow all around the house. There definitely was leaves. There was this little, I don't know exactly what you call it, with the windows that are down in the basement.
The window well. The window well.
You have a window well, and you have a grate. There's definitely evidence with leaves and stuff like that, that grate was open. The window was open. There was a suitcase used, it appears, for potentially someone to try to get back out through those windows. So, I don't think they want to solve the case because I think it'll embarrass them at this point. So they just want to just let it die, let it get over with. I've definitely said this, and I think you would agree with me, John. You know, John and I both almost 8 years ago retired from law enforcement and got into private business, if you want to call it that, as experts and consultants mainly to defense attorneys. We'll work for prosecutors, but they tend not to want to hire us. And I always make the statement, there's only one opportunity for law enforcement to screw up an investigation. especially on a major case like a homicide. If they don't do a thorough investigation, and I've talked about this before, if you don't test this, if you don't do a subpoena to Snapchat, or because I'm all about technology, if you don't get cell phone records, if you don't seize somebody's cell phone to see what's on it, there could be inculpatory or exculpatory evidence on that. And I think Boulder knows they've so screwed this case up that they are reluctant to test the stuff because they might actually solve it with 23andMe and other things like that. I mean, all they need, they don't even need for the actual killer to be in CODIS. If they have his brother, you know, or something, that's a match close enough with 23andMe and all this other stuff where they might be able to figure out who the actual killer was, because there's so many people that have actually turned in their DNA for these systems because they want to find out where they came from and all that other stuff. So obviously you would encourage the Boulder DA, I say the Boulder DA, Polis or whomever at this point, to get this stuff tested.
I mean, what's, I guess, Mark, for me at the end of the day is what harm is being done. You're looking into factual information, right? This is not some opinion developed from somebody saying, you know, I think somebody did it. This is scientific. I mean, DNA, we know, has gone through all of these, you know, a lot of trials, right? It's been tested already. They've tested the validity, the veracity, the you know, how DNA works, and more importantly, the science behind it. And so for me, you know, what is the harm in telling me that this towel or this piece of clothing or this particular, you know, evidence item contains DNA from whoever? What's the harm in that? Right. To me, there is no harm in doing that. So if you've got hundreds of items in evidence that you haven't tested and it's been 26 years, who in the heck is going to finally say enough is enough? Just get the darn thing tested so we can find out whether or not this is linked to the family or not. If this evidence is linked to the family, I'd be the first to tell you, well, you know what? That's pretty damning. But if it's not linked to the family, that's pretty damning as well. Then somebody should be saying, why are we only focused on the family? And I think that's truly what's going on here, Mark, is they don't want to know the answer to what this
is. They don't want to change the narrative.
They don't.
The narrative right now is the family got away with it.
Correct.
A family member got away with it.
And if science says it's somebody else, guess what?
They don't like that.
They don't want that.
They don't like that. So I just had to bring that up because the JonBenet thing came up. It was in the news today. Now, I really feel bad because it's literally almost a quarter till. We got like 10 more minutes.
Okay.
And we cannot. So let's do this. Let's start the conversation about Uvalde because I feel bad that I've kind of told everyone we're going to talk about this because and then we'll have like episode two on Wednesday.
Yeah.
We'll talk about
more in depth. I promise.
Yeah, because and hopefully I won't be as well. I definitely won't be. I couldn't believe the video. I couldn't, because after Columbine, and Columbine was before I got into law enforcement full time.
April 20th.
You were there because you were asked to work on the Columbine reinvestigation.
Correct.
As well. So you're very knowledgeable about Columbine. And I will tell you, since Columbine, schools have changed. I was on the school board at Lewis Palmer when we built Palmer Ridge, and it was designed with Columbine in mind. So all these things have changed in law enforcement and how we do business. Right. I mean, and I'm going to use the term again. Please don't, you know, come after me again. But basically, cops were issued assault rifles, AR-15s, which are, I will tell you, I have, well, I'm not going to tell you how many I have, but they are an excellent platform for a lot of different things and for hunting. I love the weapon, but typically all patrol cops were issued assault rifles and with shotguns because they were made specifically for this type of event, to combat this type of event. So a lot of things changed. Our training changed to where it was to basically not confine them, but to contain them, negotiate, you know, that was kind of the order of what you used to do. And now it's like, man, forget that. People are dying. Right. So it's law enforcement. And initially, when I first got full-time into law enforcement, is as soon as two people arrived, you went in. Now it's go in, grab your weapon and go in, because the first thing you're going to do is you're going to distract the shooter. I mean, there's no doubt you're going to do this. So they're going to turn their focus on killing innocent, non-armed individuals in a gun-free zone, which we refer to as a soft target. And they're going to have to turn their focus on the threat, which is the individual cop that goes in on his own with proper weaponry and confronts the shooter. That's the way it was at Uvalde. What the hell happened?
Yeah, I mean, Mark, it's when you go, I recall very clearly was never tarnish the badge, right? Like you're given this honor to protect and serve your community, right? And protect those who can't be protected, right? And so when you think about something like Uvalde, you have a shooter who is in the, I mean, if you look at the video, right? I mean, he's already shooting outside. I mean, that's how the video begins. He crashes his truck. He comes out of the vehicle. He begins to shoot at two adults. So there's already an awareness in those few seconds after he crashes that there's a shooter at a school, at an elementary school. And then you have a teacher who's actually on that same 911 call, right? That there's all these 911 calls that immediately start to come into dispatch. And she's saying, we've got kids running and we got him shooting outside at the school. Now, you know, what we know from the video is that within just a few minutes, multiple officers make their way on scene. And you know, what happens next is something that, you know, it's very difficult because, you know, you and I were in law enforcement. And I will tell you, when I watched the video, I was extremely disturbed because everything that we're trained, it seemed like everything that we were supposed to do, it was the opposite that was done that day. You know, the way they approached the particular classroom, when they did get to a certain point and the suspect began firing, you know, in their direction, they began to run away and, you know,
retreat.
And the reality is that, you know, I went to a SWAT school and I will tell you, you know, even in basic police training at police academy, they preach not losing any, what? Don't lose any ground. If you get to a certain point,
don't retreat.
Don't give up that distance that you were able to give up. And so, you know, when you watch them running away from that location, you know, it's easy for you and me to sit from our, you know, our Zoom podcast and talk about how, you know, what we would have done. But the reality is the profession is very clear that, you know, we protect the innocent and we take an oath. And unfortunately, this happened and a lot of kids died and two teachers died. And could they have saved, you know, all their lives? No. And that's not really what is at issue here. What is at issue is the way they had allowed many, many minutes to go by. I think they estimated roughly 77 minutes, I believe it is, Mark. I'll have to look at it again before we talk on Wednesday. But
well, you know, it's a total of 100 minutes, the whole beginning to end.
Again, yeah. Before they actually make an approach to actually take out the threat, over an hour had already gone by, you know, and then you watch this video of what's going on. You know, you got guys wearing sunglasses, you know, doing something like this when they're, you know, they can't see inside of the school. It's like, wait a second, what were you thinking? Guys using hand sanitizer, like,
right.
What, you know, even if there's no video, what possessed you at that particular moment while gunfire is going off and you know kids are screaming?
How can you sit there and be using your hand sanitizer on the phone, standing around, and you hear gunshots from a kid's classroom?
Right.
I can't even comprehend that. And going back to the beginning, And we'll on Wednesday, we'll talk specifically about what happens inside the school.
Sure.
But now I heard this, and I hope, you know, I hate whenever somebody, I thought it was been confirmed that there was law enforcement that saw him outside.
Yeah,
and actually radioed, and actually, I want to confirm this by Wednesday, yeah. And that that he radioed in to ask for permission to shoot at him.
Right.
And I'm going to see if I can't confirm that between now and Wednesday. But to me, that's the craziest thing. If somebody, you know, I always say, I still teach recruits that want to become law enforcement officers, and I always tell them, you know, your toughest decision is going to be when you deploy your weapon, when you shoot somebody. I mean, that's your toughest decision.
Right.
If somebody's shooting, that decision's easy. You right, know, if right. they're shooting at you or if they're shooting at somebody else, you right. see somebody right. shooting on school property, you get to shoot them. You know, and so we talked about all the missed opportunities right. that there were. And you're absolutely right. There's no way you're ever going to have, the scenario where you have zero fatalities. Now it does happen. And usually it has to do with people who stop the event before it even starts, you know, by saying, you know, I heard, you know, this happened, and they catch them ahead of time with right. intel or whatever. But I have to tell you, if somebody's shooting, you get to shoot them. If somebody comes at you with a knife, you get to shoot them. Yeah. You know, if somebody's on school property, supposed to be gun-free zone, and they have an assault rifle, again, I use that term, they have a rifle, you get to shoot them. Right. And, you know, so if that's true, I want to verify that. That could have been stopped outside. Like you said, two people, I know two adults were shot at. I know there was a teacher or somebody, a staff member or someone who saw him outside
shooting.
And I know there was law enforcement that entered that building within 8 minutes, maybe sooner. I'll try to actually get a little better.
Actually, I think Mark, it was in within 3 or 4 minutes that they actually made entry. You know,
and I see that video of them going down the hall, hearing the gunfire, and then running back. It's like, where's that in training?
Right, right. And you know, the thing that's dangerous here is that everybody's gone into protection mode, right? Everybody's trying to protect their rear end now, right? So
right.
You know, we're not getting a full understanding of what is going on. And, you know, we got to be very careful about who's investigating who during this whole thing. What they really need to do is have some really objective people to go in and evaluate everything that has no ties to the Texas Rangers, has no ties to, you know, the Border Patrol, right. has no ties to Uvalde, has no, you know, the Uvalde Police Department, Uvalde School District. It's got to be an extremely neutral party to go in and go, you know, what can we learn from this? But I will tell you, Mark, you and I had this discussion before. We talked about this almost a month ago. And the bottom line is, you know, we talked about it. And the main thing was, I think you're going to get people getting into preservation mode right now, right? Self-preservation. Who's going to maintain their jobs? Who's going to be asked to resign? Who's going to be fired? And the reality is that there are a lot of officers that I will tell you are probably personally struggling mentally with their lack of action.
Oh, I would have, if I was one of those cops that wanted to go in, and I'm sure some of them wanted to,
yeah.
And they, I don't want to say capitulated, but they listened to their supervisors. I mean, I think you see at one point in the video where that chief, that school district chief of police or whatever is sitting there on his cell phone, and I see all these stars on his shoulder. Okay. And I'm just thinking, dude, where the hell is your leadership? You should be right up. I mean, a good leader would have said, somebody give me your rifle. I'm going in first. You know, that's again, what the chief police should have said.
It's not about being a Keystone cop. But the reality is, it wasn't for a lack of resources that were available on that campus at the time of the shooting. The reality
is, in a timely fashion.
Yeah, they had a lot of police officers there. And it was the blind leading the blind, you know, and I hate to say that about, you know, a fellow officer, but that's the reality of it. They did not react to the situation. They did not take the steps necessary to eliminate the threat. And unfortunately, a lot of people died. And, you know,
and we don't know. And another sad thing, because we got to wrap this
sure,
up.
Sure.
Another important thing is, we don't know if their lack of action cost one life? We don't know.
We don't.
I mean, don't. Maybe with some investigation, they'll be able to say, but I doubt they'll be able to really say that.
Forensically,
you'll always wonder.
Yep.
You'll always wonder, because of our inaction, did we cost lives? And, you know, if I was in law enforcement and I was down there in that situation, I would resign. I mean, there's no way I could, I would move. I mean, there's no way I could stay there. But hey, so our time basically is up. We have a whole bunch more to talk about on Uvalde and stuff. We didn't even talk about tactics or some of the things specifically. I wanted to kind of go through all this stuff on what specifically happened at Uvalde. I want to talk a little bit about defunding the police or refunding the police or whatever these bozos in Washington, you know, are now trying to backpedal from, trying to walk away from the stupid craziness of thinking that things will be safer if you have less uniformed or armed police. How's that working out, New York City? And how's that working out, Chicago, Portland, Seattle? Probably not working out real well. So I want to talk about that a little bit. I know, John, you don't want to get into the political stuff, but we'll talk about it a little bit on Wednesday. And then remember, on Friday, I'm going to try to do this remote. Thomas, if you're listening, you may have to have a another show to put on for Chuck and Julie if things fail. We're going out to the ranch where my cattle was being kept. We're going to talk to Chuck. I talked to him today. He's all excited about doing this on Friday, and I'm really looking forward to it. So I hope everybody has a great Monday. We'll see you on Wednesday, and hopefully we'll all have a great week together.